Welcome back to the Pop Culture Graveyard Podcast. I am Hollis. With me, as always, is Dave. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Hollis.
Live long and prosper, Dave.
Live long and prosper. L'chaim.
L'chaim. We are kicking off part one of our two-part Star Trek, the original series, spectacular. We've been threatening. Do the whole thing. Come on. We have been threatening to do this episode for a while. This was an episode that Dave and I have kept in our back pocket as the quote-unquote, we roll out of bed and we're able to tape it podcast episode.
Have you rolled out of bed?
I've rolled out of bed. Yeah. I gussied a little, but I'm not that far removed from bed. Is that
Let's
fair?
Do the fit. Let's do the fit
All
before
right.
we get into it.
Let's look
I'm
at you.
I'm rocking the NASA original meatball insignia.
Wow.
Before they were even using the four letters.
I love it. I love it.
Yep.
And that is on point. I am wearing my In Search Of t-shirt.
That's wildly on point.
Yeah, with Leonard Nimoy, of course, the host of In Search Of. And he, of course, plays Spock in this wonderful series. The shirt was given to me by my pal, Jeff. I want to thank Jeff for that. He gave it to me a while ago. He's that friend. We went to Roswell, New Mexico together.
There you go.
We watch In Search Of together. We are big fans of that show. But I think it's safe to say that the role of Spock was the role of a lifetime for Leonard Nimoy. And the same can be said for everyone else on this show.
You're right. The role of a lifetime. And in all cases, like while they were experiencing it, I don't think they had that feeling at all.
No. I think a lot of the cast viewed this as a stepping stone. Shatner especially. He thought he was primed for big things. It's funny in retrospect, nobody on the show knew it would be big. And so if you had told them at the time, enjoy this. You know, for everyone but the two leads, Shatner and Nimoy, this is going to be your living from now on. You're going to go to shows, you're going to do autographs, you're going to like do meet and greets, but you're mainly going to be these people forever. They wouldn't have believed you.
Gene Roddenberry, more than anyone, he was trapped in it. And luckily, because nothing else he tried took off. It's a weird thing. My band played a show that was mid-size. It was like a X Games, like second stage type thing. Yeah. And we played with a couple of real bands. I forget what their names were. And there was like pretty big stages with real lights and stuff. And one of the guys in the bigger bands said to me, I just feel like telling you, enjoy that. This is the sweet spot. He's like, from here, either it's going to get less enjoyable or you're going to fail. he's like, but where you're at right now is the funnest part. Because he was asking me, he's like, you all in one van? I'm like, yeah, we're all in one. He's like, yeah, this is the best part. Enjoy it. Because either you're going to take off and it's going to get worse and worse, or you're going to fail. And that'll be it. So.
And that guy was Bob Dylan.
And that guy was Nathaniel Hornblower.
Great.
But yeah, so all of these people could have used a tap on the shoulder and say, I hope you're enjoying this because you're going to fall back on it. It's what you are.
It's funny. It's almost like in the, you know, in the wonderful movie adaptation, while they're taping, old Nimoy tapping young Nimoy and just being like, hey.
Oh, there were opportunities, right, in time travel to tap.
Yeah.
You know, you actually bring up a perfect example of what they all had to learn to do. Leonard Nimoy wrote several books, but two of them were I Am Not Spock, which he wrote while he was so annoyed with signing autographs and constantly being considered Spock. And then later he wrote I Am Spock.
Yeah. Isn't that a wonderful arc?
It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. I mean, not that you have to choose, but I'm a Nimoy guy. Like,
as am I. Yes.
Yeah. And I'm all, and most. I mean, it's a common known fact that Nimoy got most of the fan mail.
Yeah. And listen, there's a reason for that. I mean, he's designed that way. He looks great in the uniform. He's svelte as hell. You can't teach svelte. Take your shirt off all you want, Kirk. But, you know, Spock just is in great shape. I think they say he has the strength of two normal humanoid men.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's able to read minds. He's able to pinch an adversary and have them unconscious.
Thereby removing the need for the punch out that we've talked about in the past.
Yeah.
Anything that would call for the punch knockout, you got a much more civilized neck nerve pinch from Spock. Right.
There's something mystical about him, you know? And then you bring into it the ears and that haircut, which is like a nerd kid haircut. Mm-hmm. It's like the kind of like your mom sits you down and cuts it to the cross. And somehow, against all odds, he looks cool.
Mm-hmm.
He's got blue eyeshadow.
He does have eyeshadow.
That's like, I assume, a Vulcan thing. And then a few episodes, I look over at McCoy. I'm like, why are you wearing blue eyeshadow? He must have been like, I like the way he's doing that. Can you do what you did for Leonard? Like, so Dave mentioned Gene Roddenberry. He was the executive producer. He's the creator of the series. He sold it to Desilu Productions, headed up by Lucille Ball and her husband at the time, whose name escapes me, the Cuban.
Desi Arnaz.
Thank you. Desi Arnaz, the inventor of the repeat. Lucy believed in the show, even when it was failing later, and she gave it new legs. So it was on Desilu Productions from 66 to 68. And in 1968, Paramount Television took it over until 69. That was the last season. You know, Dave, we like to have fun sometimes with the inflation calculator. Season one, the budget was $190,000 per episode. Do you know what that is equivalent to in 2023 money? Because we don't have all of 2024.
Right, for our stats. Now, I couldn't take a guess.
$1.8 million per episode. No wonder it went off the air.
Yeah. I would think someone was embezzling. I'd be like, these rocks look a lot like styrofoam.
Yeah.
It's a dog with a unicorn horn.
My favorite low budget effect is the dog with the unicorn horn.
And then it turns out there's two of them.
Yeah.
The mean one and the nice one.
That's great.
We just did Jaws. Jaws is similar. An entire thing built around it of fandom and just details and all the interesting things.
It's an industry to itself.
Yeah. So you even without trying, like people, if someone says, I know nothing about Star Trek, that means they know a dozen things about Star Trek. They know Beam Me Up, Scotty. They know the Vulcan hand sign. Like some stuff is just...
It's hard not to have something to see through.
Yeah, you're going to have something in there. One of the things that I know is that Star Trek's budget was cut every year, and it shows.
Mm. Well, they didn't only recycle sets, but they recycled storylines a lot. You know, there were maybe two or three episodes where Kirk wasn't really Kirk. You know, there's like two or three episodes where the solution is a high-pitched frequency. There are all these kind of devices. But you might forget through the mists of time just how influential this show was in the respect that so many subsequent shows, and I'm not just talking about sci-fi shows, stole plot lines from Star Trek, stole kind of motivations for characters from Star Trek. You know, it was a paradigm for a lot of good television after it. And I think that's a testament to the cult audience that got built up after the show, during the show, but then after the show went off the air, it just built and built and built. Mm-hmm. And so half of the shows you love today only exist as a legacy to Star Trek, because there wasn't geek culture before it. There wasn't cosplay stuff before it. There wasn't so many things you take for granted today about current shows that are given a chance to live.
Yeah.
Thanks to Star Trek.
The word con, not K-H-A-N, C-O-N for convention, originally had the word Star Trek in front of it. It was a Star Trek convention that popularized these costumed conventions. And you've got the Saturday Night Live skit where Shatner berates his fan base.
So good.
So good. And we discussed it in
Galaxy Quest.
Galaxy Quest.
Oh my God. Yeah, talk about a great inspiration.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a turning point in geek culture. My father, he's a huge sci-fi fan. He gets very little sci-fi. You know, no, there's not a lot, you know, you either read it or you wait for a movie every 3 or 4 years.
Right.
After Star Trek, sci-fi started coming fast and furious.
It's true. Yeah. You know, I think we're getting to the point, because I love everything you say about your dad, we got to start making him a sort of mascot for the show. I want to see, you got to make a little cartoon of him in a Speedo, have him like up in the corner or something. He's got to be a kind of like talisman for the show, because I love that he's somehow apt in every show. There's some kind of story that
I'll work him in.
Yeah. Yeah,
it won't be hard to make that little character, because my dad looks a decent amount like Bob from Bob's Burgers.
Great.
Yeah.
You know, on a separate note, as far as you mentioning people, I can't believe that last episode was The Life Aquatic, and we went the whole episode doing this Bill Murray movie, and you didn't mention Meatballs once. It might be the only episode reference Bill Murray as Trip in Meatballs during a Bill Murray episode.
Interesting.
Yeah. So just finishing up with Gene Roddenberry, if you recall, television before it was nothing but Westerns, it seemed.
Cops and cowboys, yeah.
Cops and cowboys.
It was almost entirely cowboys, with cops leaking, starting to happen, yeah.
Yes. And so all of a sudden, it seemed, there were these hip shows. There were The Man from U.N.C.L.E., there was Batman, and there was Star Trek. It was these hard left turns, and they were just cool. They were campy, and they were
more colorful too. They were colorful. Like different looking. Yeah.
Yes, and so really brought a lot of new stuff. But Gene Roddenberry pitched it as Wagon Train to the Stars, because Wagon Train was a big Western at the time, and that's what sold it. Like we said in the Jaws episode, we're not going to tread on really well-trodden ground as far as Star Trek is concerned. But I did want to mention Gene Roddenberry, so important, the father of the series. Gene L. Kuhn is important. And Fred Freiberger, or Freeberger. Those guys were important. Yeah.
DC Fontana, yeah.
You bring up DC Fontana, it's a good time to mention that this show was a playground for stellar sci-fi writers such as Richard Matheson, who you know if you've ever watched Twilight Zone, Harlan Ellison, Jerome Bixby, and Theodore Sturgeon. It gave a voice to female writers, which not a lot of shows at the time were doing, such as DC Fontana and Margaret Armin. So you weren't just seeing diversity in front of the camera, Matt Damon. You were seeing it behind the camera. And that is a wonderful legacy of this series.
Yeah, Harlan Ellison. I read one Harlan Ellison book.
That's more than
I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
Oh, great title.
I'll tell you what, though. Don't let the great titles fool you. A lot of times you see this title and you're like, wow, that sounds so... A Mote in God's Eye. A Mote in God's Eye. What do you think of that, right? I forget the author. But I was like, wow. And I read it and I was like, oh my God, it's about a small planet in a galaxy called God's Eye.
Oh, come on.
And I'm like, don't be so literal with it. You had the greatest thing.
I hate when people shoot their wad on the title. Like,
that's rough.
That's terrible.
And these sci-fi authors who were writing episodes, there's also a sort of after the fact, sci-fi writers were getting into writing books based on Star Trek. This is James Blish. Ooh. Spock Must Die.
Oh, great title.
I think maybe riffing on the Edith Keeler Must Die phrase. But yeah, sci-fi writer assisted and later sci-fi writer influencing. A lot of people think that Star Trek episodes are adaptations of sci-fi stories.
Right.
And they're not. I mean, some are based on sci-fi stories.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of them are just from scratch sci-fi concepts. A lot of them are very similar.
Yeah. And a lot of these writers wrote for other series. You know, I mentioned The Twilight Zone, but these were pros and they moved from series to series and they were real professionals. And they were like, so what's the deal with this show? Oh, okay. I got it. And they'll bang out a 50-page script. Yeah. Like these guys were workhorses. I really admire them. Dave, I've always felt at its heart, this series is about a starship commander who seems unable or unwilling to delegate responsibility. Captain Kirk beams down for every single mission, no matter how trivial. You know, Captain, we're out of toilet paper. I'd better go down there. Spock, Bones, every other high-ranking officer, join me. Because without that, you don't have a show. You need to put them through their paces. But it's funny to me how they don't, if you want to do that, then make the guy like, you know, the grunt who has all the shit assignments, send him down there. But the
captain, I guess that's kind of what Lower Decks is about. There's a cartoon called Lower Decks, which follows not the people of the bridge. It follows the people of the lower decks, people who are new to the Enterprise, people who clean up on the Enterprise. So it's in that realm, but it's a cartoon and it's a little annoying.
I haven't seen it.
But yeah, that's one of the suspensions of disbelief when you're going to watch a show about a starship.
Right.
Yeah, your main characters are going to beam down to the planet every time. It's like sending up the president, the vice president, and the speaker of the house in an old helicopter. Like,
it really is.
What are you doing? That's our entire leadership set.
Yeah.
You know, if anything bad happens on that planet, we're going to be run by Nurse Kelly, you know.
Nurse Kelly, I love that you brought up a MASH.
Oh, wait.
Instead of Chapel.
Chapel. Yeah, that's who I'm thinking. Nurse Kelly. That's great. She's going to do a cameo. But yeah, and another suspension that you run into is whenever they meet a civilization. The civilization seems weirdly like has a focus in a small spot where everything can happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. If I came up upon a planet and I was like, okay, let's beam down. It's like, where do we, in China, New York?
Yeah. Cancun?
Kokomo?
It got nice weather. You know, yeah. There's suspension of disbelief in sci-fi.
There has to be. The mere premise.
But like in hard sci-fi books, it's almost like their job is to prove, they say things and then they prove it. It's possible. Right. It's possible. It's possible. Right. And then there's sci-fi that just has fun with it. But when you're on TV, the very first thing you're going to do is put five or six people on the bridge standing there. You don't stand in a ship that's moving through space.
Yeah.
You almost certainly never will. I don't care
They've conquered that. Dampers. They've conquered the whole strap you in thing. Like, you have to accept those kind of things. As in, you know, we always see the model in the opening and it's flying through space every opening. They never do the thing where they do in the movies today where you see a character and then you pull out and you can see what part of the ship they're on or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love that.
But like in that weird ship, I don't even know how it's built, if what we're seeing inside is what we're seeing inside. But like the elevators are going up, but the decks are kind of drawn out and and yet it's circular so you can walk around it. And yet that's only the bridge sort of.
I think that speaks to how big it is. I'm not sure. Does the elevator go into that main shaft maybe that goes down to the Norelco Razor section?
Yeah, it would have to, but maybe it doesn't. Like that's, you have to suspend disbelief every second of the show.
And was fine with it from Star Trek all the way up until a couple of years ago, they made The Expanse. And The Expanse decided to obey gravity. And I highly recommend The Expanse. Maybe the third scene in the entire series is someone putting their magnetic boots down on the deck. When I saw that scene, I said, oh my God, I think this series is going to acknowledge gravity. Mm. And I got chills. I was like, this is huge. I was like, this is a major shift.
Yeah, you've spoken glowingly of that show in the past.
Yeah, all of these shows ignore gravity and ignore language. You know, a lot of English speaking aliens.
Wow. Yeah. It's a testament to the actors on the show. that it has stood the test of time. Such great performances. And when you come down to it, you know, there's a few scenes where it's just Kirk alone on the bridge, and it's like the rest of the people have beamed down, or, you know, there's a few lonely episodes. And when you see the bridge desolate like that, it looks like a set. It looks like a kind of cheesy TV set. And it's only when you populate it with actors pretending to push buttons and levers and looking through visors, it looks like a ship.
That's a really good point. The people are making it work. Yeah, they really are.
And I think if you extrapolate that out, the actors are why this entire series works. They're really, really locked in. And it reminds me of something I love about TV stars of the 50s and 60s, which was, of course, the heyday of television. They paid their dues. You know, these are all people that have been kicking around a while. You didn't get your own series until you were like in your 30s a lot of time, maybe sometimes not your 40s.
DeForest Kelly had been in like 100 episodes of other shows.
Yeah, before a lot of Westerns, Star Trek. Yeah. And Shatner
always a bad
as well.
Guy. He was super excited to play a doctor.
And Shatner as well. He had been in lots of TV movies. He had been in failed series. He had been guest starring on stuff. He's in a couple of the best Twilight Zones ever.
Yeah.
Nick of Time and Nightmare at whatever, Thousand Feet.
Something Thousand Feet.
Those people were seasoned veterans, and they really knew what they were doing, and they gave it their all. And, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a movie that we love and we covered, is set in like 1969. And it's kind of the beginning of the end of what I'm talking about. You know, there they kind of gloss over a character called Bingo Martin. Scott Brown plays Bingo Martin. He's this kid, Scott Brown. They were starting to give series to kids and starting to give series to young guys that didn't pay their dues. And I don't know.
Yeah, just because he had that something. They started giving out series because he had that something.
Yeah, that and star like, quality.
You're going to find out that that something doesn't translate to 100 episodes.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I could picture Rick Dalton. I could picture the handsome guy who he does the scene with.
Stacy.
I could picture either of them getting the Kirk role.
I could see another thing with, instead of The Great Escape, they put a clip from Star Trek. You were up for the role of Kirk.
Yeah. Could totally be that. Could totally be that. Sulu did a movie during Star Trek. He did a John Wayne movie. He missed almost a whole season. That's when they brought in Koenig.
Walter Koenig?
Walter Koenig, the Russian.
Well, as far as I know, they brought in Koenig specifically because.
Hold on, here it comes.
They wanted somebody to be a Davy Jones type to get that monkey's appeal. Fan.
I knew. I was like, Hollis is going to bring up this Davy Jones checkoff.
Well, I wouldn't have if you hadn't prompted me. But...
He's got the haircut.
Yeah, it's great.
It's good. Any other show would have avoided a Russian guy like crazy. But this was a future where Americans and Russians were on the same ship together. And you could have a black communications officer and so on. And so, you know, I read that Gene Roddenberry, the show he was working on before this was like a Army or Navy show, but he was working on it and he was trying to pump up the diversity in it, but they were getting a bunch of money from the armed forces because it was kind of it helped recruitment. And the armed forces asked them to tone down the diversity because they weren't looking for diverse volunteers.
Yeah.
And Gene Roddenberry quit.
Love
and
it.
Then the next thing he did was Star Trek and he turned up the diversity. There's some diversity stories that we have to tell. We have to tell Sulu's diversity story. We have to tell Uhura's diversity story. Sulu's family held in an internment camp after Pearl Harbor in a national move that is to this day attempted to be swept under the rug. And Uhura leaving after the first season and then being told by Martin Luther King to go back.
Yeah.
Too important. Like, you know how I love to say, like, oh, they made up that story because it's great for interviews. Like, that story, there may not be a better story.
It's too good to be true, and yet it's true.
And in this case, it happens to be true. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it in different movies. People seeing themselves on screen.
It's everything.
When you stop and think back then, you know, I could name on like one hand the black women on television. You know, it was Uhura, and then it was Peggy on Mannix. And mm-hmm. then the first lead was Julia with the beautiful Diane Carroll. So, like, there were not a lot of black women on television. And for her to walk away, like, you know, it could have been anyone who told her, but coming from Dr. King, I mean, you got to listen there.
That's bizarre. Someone came up to her at a gala of some sort and said, there's a fan that wants to meet you. And in her head, as she, when she tells the story, it's great. She's like, she sees someone walking towards her and she goes, that fan is going to have to wait because Martin Luther King is walking right at me. And then you think even about Chekhov could represent several things, but he can also represent someone with a thick accent. It's not easy to have a thick accent in America in the 60s.
Yeah. Chekhov is the Chano of Star Trek.
Yeah. That's giving maybe Chekhov too much credit.
Yeah. Yeah. Dave, we have not talked about Scotty.
Oh, we can't. Oh, my God. We can't forget Scotty.
And this, you know, we say it all the time. This isn't other podcasts. You're not going to get us saying Scotty's catchphrases or anything like that.
No, we're not even going to bring up Jeffrey's tubes.
Oh, my God.
You're not familiar with Jeffrey's tubes?
No, I'm so sorry.
It's one of those tubes that he has to climb into to fix things.
That has a name?
Yeah, it's a Jeffrey's tube.
He was constantly squeezing himself into this little sweat box. You know, it was like at the core of the ship, I always felt.
Sometimes it was like filled with lightning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those were the Jeffrey's tubes.
Oh my God. And
I feel like they called them the Jeffrey's tubes, not to honor him, but to be like, that's the guy, that's the jerk who put those panels in that tube.
Oh, that's great.
And we constantly have to go in there. Obviously, those panels should have been somewhere else.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Okay, you know, we are going to talk about the Jeffrey's tubes.
A little bit. I think we just did. But Scotty, I loved Scotty as a kid. His accent is fun. He's the first Scottish guy I ever heard.
I didn't know it was a put-on accent.
Yeah, so pitch perfect is that accent that no one knew, I think.
Apparently, it's Aberdeen-based.
I could see that.
Yeah, it's like a specific one.
Well done,
yeah.
James Doohan as Scotty. He was great. I loved when Scotty was in charge on the bridge. There were a few episodes where Kirk was taken hostage, or like Spock and Kirk were stranded on a planet, and people would try to negotiate with Scotty, and he was like, I'll blow up the ship first. Like, it was, he had no chill, and I love that. I'm here for that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so true. And like, you know, when they would leave, you know, at the first sign of danger, get out of here, Scotty. Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm going to do that. Like, I just did his Scottish with a touch of Canadian, which is what he is. He's another great Canadian.
You know, there's a wacky thing to him, and it happened with a bunch of people. And I don't know if this was the jump from season 2 to season 3, where they changed production companies and, you know, it was like kind of they were gearing up again. But Scotty's hair changed. He had the comb down. He had like an Elliot Smith almost. It was like a hipster Brooklyn kind of cut over his forehead. Yeah. Well, and then he went to like a pushback, like almost like a mafia soldier. Weird, like blown back. And he had a little sideburn.
Both bad,
action.
In my opinion. I mean,
both very bad.
If you watch it on the YouTube, I'm sure Hollis put a couple of pictures up. It's rough stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It aged him greatly.
Yeah. I mean, when you've got Kirk with the perfect, oh, well, of course his hair was perfect. He kept it in a box.
Yeah. And he never had a toupee that good again, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
The beautiful thing about the Blu-ray editions is that if you go close up on it, you can see the spirit glue kind of that brings it to a widow's peak. And he's got just that little tuft. And you're like, why would anyone just grow that tuft? So it seems real.
Yeah.
You know, it reads seamlessly integrates. And by the time of T.J. Hooker, of course, he's wearing like, you know, Amazon Women on the Moon. Have you ever seen that? It's like hair looming. But this was the best toupee he ever had. You know, those guys were geniuses.
He looked great. Doohan must have been pissed coming out of that chair.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand.
This is what you give me.
It's every time.
But, you know, one final thing on diversity, and then we'll move on, is that it's a lot to see the main characters having some diversity. But it also means a lot to simply see crew members walking around that are diverse. I saw plenty of Black members of the engineering and science and security teams. I saw several Asian officers and people just walking around taking tricorder readings.
Yeah, the walking by people were always carefully diverse.
Yeah. 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 So it's a good thing.
And the one-off roles when they bring in the computer expert, when they try to use AI and they accidentally kill several hundred people with AI.
Yeah.
That's a black scientist.
They bring in Blackula. I always...
What's the actor's name?
He's William Marshall, I think is his name.
Oh, yeah.
Let me look.
I think you're right. No, I think you got it on the first
try. Yeah, okay, good. Beautiful, like Shakespearean voice.
Yeah, yeah, that's
this actor.
He's the guy in the AI computer episode, yeah.
Great. Great.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's great. And I mean, let's just, I don't want to dwell on this because we're two dudes on a podcast, but some of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life to this day, I first encountered on Star Trek episodes. It's like a beauty contest, a lot of episodes.
Whenever I go back to Star Trek, I think I'm going to have to set aside how short those skirts are. Those skirts don't exist.
They're like tennis outfits, kind of.
They're almost not wearing anything.
You know, this was the era of the Playboy Bunny. And it's very much got that kind of sex kitten thing to it, the uniforms, the female uniforms. But they're not functional. Like, Nichelle Nichols sits on nothing but her underpants in that
chair. Yeah, she literally does. Yeah. And I just watched an episode where the ship rocked back and forth a couple of times. And I saw more of Nichelle Nichols than I had planned to.
You were not upset about that, be honest.
Oh, a little. I felt like she wouldn't have wanted me to see.
Yeah. Know better than Dr. King, do you? Dr. King liked the ladies. We know that.
Oh, we do know that. So did Roddenberry.
Yeah. I will say this, if anyone has a problem with some of the skin-bearing costumes that a lot of the women used on the show, I think it's unfair to take a show out of its time frame and judge it by our much more, hopefully, evolved standards. It might be throwing the baby out with the bathwater because of all the good that the show did and its overall overreaching message of peace and acceptance and diversity and everything else.
And a very specific message of women are capable. Our communications officer is Uhura. The leader of Vulcan is a woman. I believe they have their ship's computers repaired on a planet that's entirely female.
And the voice of the computer is female.
Yeah. If you have to look at it as a whole, and that helps to say like, oh, I guess the dress thing may have been an artifact of the time. Because when I look at everything else, it seems like he's trying to raise women.
Also, it started in 1966. The miniskirt was never bigger. 66, 67, 68. That's the height of the miniskirt. I could show you miniskirts on Columbo and Mannix and everything. It was the 60s version of what the future would look like. And so that bridge is almost mid-century modern. Like, there's a lot of space age, atomic age kind of style to the furniture, to the uniforms, to everything. I mean, the pants and boots that the guys wear are like, we're opening for the Beatles next week, you know?
Yeah, those boots, yeah. And the flared pants.
So
yeah. Spandex jackets, one for everyone.
Yeah. So to find fault with the miniskirts on the female crew is kind of to find fault with miniskirts as a movement in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's a great argument.
Thank you. So when I was rewatching these episodes, or as many as I could for this taping, the Blu-ray discs offered me a choice of watching with enhanced special effects or watching with the original special effects. And I kind of laughed to myself and I'm like, who wants the enhanced special effects? For me, nostalgia is a key component to the show. And I find it charming to see these attempt at special effects in the day. They didn't ask me if I wanted to see Shatner without his toupee. Like, so it just.
I have a small defense.
Yeah, please.
First of all, the special effects, as we mentioned, they had a great budget and the special effects were amazing for their time. But they were for their time and they were on televisions, televisions that were made up of like, I don't know how many, I don't even think they called them pixels at the time, but only these things had like 11 pixels.
Give or take.
But now you're looking at a Blu-ray on a super high def television. I believe the intent was not to give it amazing special effects, but to raise the special effects to the point where they matched the current form of viewing that you were doing. So it's not like the Star Wars thing where now a giant sheet of light comes out of the exploding planet.
Right.
It's not like where the ray gun was a red line, now it's a flaming. It was just a better red line. I was unable to watch it in its original form because I was watching on Paramount or something. But I have in the past checked out like, oh, what are these improvements to the special effects? And I have to say, they were all within reason.
Okay, that's good to hear.
There are orchestral accompaniments to nearly every facial expression, every punch, every kiss, just massive flourishes from the orchestra.
So good.
It's huge. It works really well.
Yeah. And then there are some episodes like Amok Time, where Spock goes home to Spawn, where that music, I just love that music. It is so good. And it's mocked in Cable Guy. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Jim Carrey is fighting and he actually does the music like
while he's fighting.
Yeah, it's so good.
That music becomes the soundtrack to what they call Shatner Fu, which is all the various roles and stuff that I don't remember where I heard that, but somebody used the term
Shatner Fu. I never heard that. Oh, yeah. No, I got to find that out.
It's all of that. The double-handed, that you're a fan of, the double axe handle. Double axe handle and the flip and roll.
Right. It's all on display.
That's the first cut shirt. Is in Amok Time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. That's one of my favorites. I was trying to think of my favorite episodes. One that came to mind was Amok Time because it's heavy Spock. And I love Spock. And it's from beginning to end. It's like something's wrong with Spock. It's got chapters like a book. And it's so wonderful the way it unravels. And then he calls McCoy his friend for the first time in that episode. He wants him to be one of his seconds along with Kirk. It's got one of my favorite actresses who was in Twilight Zone, Columbo, Arlene, I'm blanking, but she plays T'Pring. Arlene Martell, I think was her name.
Okay.
She's just fantastic. Anyway.
It has my favorite Spock scene of all time.
Oh, it's that gym. Tiny,
it's the gym.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Oh, that's great.
It is so good. He thinks Kirk is dead.
I've killed my captain. I'm going to... Yeah. Court martial
yeah,
myself.
Do this. I want you to do this. I want you to do that. And he's like, don't you think you should check with me first? And he turns around and he's, Jim! And he cracks a huge smile. And then he catches it and crunches it back to Spock. And DeForest Kelly's eyebrow goes up like, eh?
And they milk it. They try to hold it.
The rest of the scene is DeForest in a pig's ear. I was merely excited that the ship would have a viable captain.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Yeah. No, that's fantastic.
That's my favorite Spock moment of all time.
That may be the best Spock moment. I'm glad you brought that up.
Spock on a liar.
Oh, God, help it. That whole fucking episode is bonkers. But I would have called Arena one of my favorite episodes where Kirk fights the Gorn. But upon rewatch, it's a little too Kirk heavy for me. You know, it's almost the equivalent of the Hawkeye has a concussion episode of MASH. But it's also got that nugget of him building the explosive device that was spoofed in Galaxy Quest.
Do you see any combustible minerals around?
See if you can fashion a rudimentary lathe. Yeah.
I forgot that Arena actually has, if you forget about those Kirk and the Gorn, there's a lot of great action. There's huge explosions. There's great diving. They're all ripped up and bloody and bruised. Yeah. There's a bunch of great stuff before some of course, Almighty Alien takes the captain from one ship and the captain and says fight. At which end,
and the alien going,
I won't do it.
Yeah, the alien looks like a Greek god, like with a little child's voice, and he's glowing, of course.
And he stands on the rocks.
He stands on the rocks. Yeah. Yes. He's like, perhaps says, there's hope for you yet.
There it is. Yeah. Another one of those condescending Greek aliens.
That's something that they went to again and again, is the kind of like superior being that's like almost day the earth stood still kind of way of like, oh, you want to destroy yourselves? Okay, destroy yourselves. At the end, you know, Kirk and his crew show how advanced they are. And so they're allowed whatever. But that's a thing, that kind of hand of God thing where they keep bringing in superior aliens.
And they always get out of it with, human beings are more complex than we originally thought. We're surprised at what human beings are capable of. It's very egotistical of humanity.
It's very self-serving.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the point of the show. Is like,
it is.
It's a very positive show that way.
How pro-human the show is, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah. Sci-fi shows didn't used to be that pro-human. Oh, yeah. So what, do they really have to shove humanity down our throats?
In rewatching, I really thought Space Seed with Ricardo Montalban was going to be one of my favorites again. I was like, you know what? I remember it being so great because Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, is such a great movie. And the elements are all in the original. And I watched, and Montalban's performance was great. But the episode itself, I was a little let down by. And forget the fact that Ricardo was basically in brownface playing.
Yeah, that's a little rough.
You know, a Sikh. And there's some fun stuff. Like we see him doing like the Charles Atlas isometric tension.
Isometric exercises, yeah.
It didn't pack the punch I thought it would. Do you remember that one?
I didn't go back and rewatch it, so I don't have that in my mind.
Was there one that you were like, oh, this is going to be great, and you rewatched it, and you were like, meh.
Yeah, Nazis.
Oh, yeah.
I forget the name of it. Patterns of Force, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one where they have to go on undercover and they end up wearing Nazi uniforms and rescue the old leader. Yeah, it's ugly.
Yeah, and it's a guy who believes strongly that Nazis had a lot right. And if I just used the control part of the Nazi and left out the hate part, I'd be able to...
Right. You know, Dave, I wanted to end part one on an upbeat, fun thing. So I asked you about, I thought you would throw out some innocuous thing, and it's the biggest downer in the history of episodes.
I changed my vote to Trouble with Tribbles.
We're going to land it there. We're going to come back with more in part two. We're going to talk fun episodes, and we're going to explore the cast a little more. So please join us for part two. Thank you, Dave. I will see you in a different t-shirt for part two.
Live long and rock on.
Live long. I did it naturally.
Hollis and Dave would like to thank you for enjoying Pop Culture Graveyard.